Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Tuesday, October 10th, 2023. Thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate your viewership. It's always great to be able to be on WVW-TV, and we're thankful for your continued support of our network and our programming, not only as viewers, but also as donors and people who support the efforts of this ministry to continue bringing information into the great marketplace of ideas. We're very happy that you continue to watch the show. We're eager to share great ideas and great thoughts and great analysis. And we're very thankful that you've tuned in. As you know, the sponsor of my show is Swiss America Trading, which is a precious metals dealer in Arizona, an American company. And they're a very big sponsor in VWTV. They've certainly been helpful for a very long time. And we're very thankful for the work that they do and the support they give us. If you're interested at all in expanding your personal portfolio into tangible precious metals, which means owning coins or bullion coins or bullion or numismatic type coins, certainly you should give Swiss America a call. They're one of the great players in that space, a great reputation, long track record of successfully supplying the marketplace. And give them a call at 519-6271 and ask them to send you some free information. They're happy to do that. Or you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com. And if you do that, go use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report. If you use the promo code Eastman, they will send you the information and you can shop around on their site and see what they have to offer. And when you are investing in tangible metals, you certainly want to be dealing with a reputable dealer, and Swiss America Trading certainly fits the bill. So if you're interested at all, give them a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website and have a look around, and keep in mind that they are generous and kind sponsors to this network here in WVW-TV. Let's jump into the news, and of course, the news, of course, today is bleak. It's always a difficult time, but I think the events of this weekend in the Middle East have certainly set the financial world on edge. You know, it's not a reason to speculate on the good fortune or bad fortune of anyone, especially when a war breaks out, but it does, in fact, have a dramatic impact on financial markets, because wars are very dangerous and very expensive and very violent, and people, it's the news reports that are continuing to come out of Israel are just shocking. It's just hard to believe that that type of pent-up anger is unleashed, and it's very difficult to see how this comes out, you know, in a sane way. This is going to be a rebalancing. I wanted to comment. As a result of, you know, all of the international turmoil, there's a couple of interesting stories that I wanted to comment on. And one of them is, as we know, Secretary Janet Yellen is the Treasury Secretary of the United States. And of course, as the Treasury Secretary, her job is to administer the budget of the executive. The United States has a treasurer, but there is the Treasury Secretary, and that's the administrative position that basically makes sure there's enough money to pay all the bills. And keep in mind, Secretary Yellen has a long history in financial regulation and finance. She's certainly no novice to the position of Treasury Secretary. If you recall back in the Obama administration days, she was actually the chair of the Federal Reserve, and it's the position that Jerome Powell now holds today. She has also been in that position. So while, you know, you try not to think of a Treasury Secretary as being a political person, they're more of a financial person. But certainly when Janet Yellen speaks as Treasury Secretary, a lot of people listen very carefully, because she has deep, vast knowledge of how the federal government is funded and how the Federal Reserve creates money and the money supply. So, I mean, she is well worth listening to every time she speaks. And I noticed that she had a chance recently to speak on the situation in the bond markets. And this is reportedly and statistically the worst bear bond market in the history of the country. What's a bear market? Well, that's a market that goes down. There's bulls that go up and bears that go down. And we're in a bear market that is very, very frightening right now. When you look at the long treasuries, these are the longer term treasury bonds, the 30 years, the 20 year, the 10 year. Those long treasuries on average lost 46% of their market value since the year 2020. It's 46% loss of market value. And the leader, the 30-year bond, that's the longest government bond issued. You know, they have the ability to issue longer, but for purposes of the market, the 30-year bond is the long bond. I mean, that's what long-term money invests in. If you're an insurance company or a pension fund or maybe a long-term money sovereign fund, you would look to a long horizon. And if you can sell a bond, or excuse me, if you can buy a bond with a high interest rate and lock it in for 30 years, you've done a good job. The 30-year bonds are trading at a 53% discount since 2020. It's not 46, it's 53. So they're driving that push for lower bond valuations. Now let me explain what this means, because we see these numbers and oftentimes, you know, okay, that sounds bad. I absorb that information. But let me explain again how a bond works. In theory, a bond is denominated in $1,000 units. Okay. One bond is $1,000. So if I give you $1,000 and you give me a bond, then it's a note, it's an IOU, it's a note. And effectively what it means is I'll give you $1,000 and you give me this note that you'll pay me back in 30 years, okay? Well, interest rates go up and down. We can see this every day. The rates are up, the rates are down. You know, they're fluid and they react to not only supply and demand pressures, the demand for bonds, the supply of available bonds, but also global issues like we're seeing in the Middle East and other stimulus. So effectively what happens, and this is algebraic, if you were to go to college and study finance or economics, one of the early classes, and maybe the Finance 101, I think probably, would be teaching you that if you put the $1,000 in, and let's say it's a one-year note is a short-term, bond is a long-term. You put it in for a year at 5%, and what you're going to end up with is a $50 return on that bond. So if you buy this bond on January 1st and you hold it to December 31st, well, the next day your doorbell rings and here's the guy giving you $1,000 back plus $50 interest. Okay. The interest is paid at the end. Maybe it'll be paid halfway through the year. So effectively what that means is if you give the $1,000 to the person who borrows it and they come back dutifully and they pay you, you know, on the 365th or 66th day, whatever, it's the 1 year with interest, then that bond is complete. It's a complete contract. And there was, you know, a meeting of the minds and consideration, and this was a contract, IOU. You give me the, you know, you give me $1,000, I'll give it back with $50 interest at the end of the year. That's the way this thing works. And all right, so let's say I gave the $1,000 to somebody, and I'm now, you know, it's now, you know, on January 1st, you know, my New Year's resolution is to give $1,000 to somebody, and they'll give it back to me at the end of the year with $50. And it gets to be April 15th. Let's pick that. That's a convenient day. And lo and behold, I filled out my tax return, and oh, I owe the IRS $1,000. Well, I check the couch cushions. I look in the, you know, the glove box in my car. I look under the easy chair, and I cannot scrape together $1,000 to pay my taxes. But I must pay my taxes on time, otherwise I'll be in trouble. So I have this bond, and I go back to the guy, and I say, "Man, you know, I'm really sorry, but you know, I've got to pay the IRS. It's April 15th." And the bondholder will say, no, I have a 1 year contract and I owe you this money on December 31st with $50. And I'm not in breach because it's not December yet. OK, so you have no right to get that bond back. OK, so what do I do? I'm stuck now. OK, he won't give me the money. I know, I'll sell the bond to somebody else. So I will go around to my other friends, if I have any friends, that are, and they say, look, I have this bond, and old Bill there is going to give me the $1,000 back on December 31st with $50 interest. And, you know, Bill's rock solid. I mean, he's like the federal government. You know, you can trust Bill. He'll pay you. Well, the friend is going to look at that bond and say, well, you know, I have to wait, you know, it's April 14th and a half, or April 15th at 3 p.m. I'm going to have to wait till December. And, you know, there's a time value of money. And I say, yeah, but you'll get, you know, you'll get the $50. Well, let's say the interest rate has gone up to 6% instead of 5%. And my friend can go out and lend $1,000 to somebody else and get $60 at the end of the year. He's not going to take yours for $50 when he can get a different bond for $60. Okay. So what happens is I have to discount the value of the bond on April 15th so that the guy that buys it is going to get the equivalent of 6% instead of 5%. Now, he's still going to get the $1,000 back. He's still going to get the check for $50 at the end of December, but he's going to pay less than $1,000. It'll be a haircut. There's going to be less. And this is all algebraic. And that's what you learn in Finance 101. You learn these very simple formulas that effectively show that as interest rates go up and down, the market value of that $1,000 bond is going up and down in an inverse relationship. As rates go up, the bond shrinks in value. Now, I can hold it to December 31st, and I can get my $1,000 back, and I can get my $50. That's the contract. That was the deal. And but if I wanted to cash out early, there's going to be this discount in the event that the interest rates change, okay? And that's effectively what is happening in the global market. When you buy bonds, very few people are expecting to hold these bonds to maturity. 30 years is a long time. Guy my age probably is not a good investment of the money for 30 more years. But, you know, maybe a young person coming out of college would put all their money in the 30-year bond, and 30 years later they're going to have the bond plus the interest. Inflation will have destroyed all the value. But the point is, the bond markets are fluid and they're daily, and these bonds are always priced. And they're not only priced by, you know, an individual, they're priced by very sophisticated finance people with master's degree and PhDs in this stuff. And there's also computers and algorithms. So when you go into the bond market, bonds are trading like this all day long, because every little inflection in the interest rate and the supply and demand and other factors, they make bonds a real spongy thing until the maturity date, which is the next date of certainty, assuming the guy doesn't default, the bond issuer doesn't default, then you're going to get your $1,000 and you'll get the coupon rate of interest. So the big problem is in the bond market globally, it's, I don't know, $122 trillion is a vast ocean of debt. And if you're a money manager and you run a pension fund or a mutual fund or a 401k or an IRA pool of money, you buy bonds as a speculative instrument, just like a stock. Stock goes up, stock goes down, bonds go up, bonds go down. And the value of these bond funds are, it's like a wave. It's just, you know, it kind of, and what you want to do is pick a money manager where, you know, the wave is going up, okay? Well, when you have a traumatic event in the interest rate structure, and because interest rates are a mathematical function that determines the value on a daily basis of a bond, mark to market, at the end of the day, when the market closes, they got to value your bond based on the interest rates and the time to maturity and all of this stuff. What happens is that the bond value of the outstanding debt shrinks. And while that's probably not a big deal for an insurance company or a pension fund with an infinite long-term horizon, you can buy a 4% bond and hold it for 30 years. There's still going to be an insurance company, and they made their 4%, and they ladder it. You know, okay, I got this one at 4%. I got this one at 4.2. Oh, I could only get 3.9 today. Oh, but now I'm at 4.6. And you structure your bonds, and that's what money managers that do debt instruments do all day as a living. Your skill in that space and your compensation is based upon your ability to rummage through millions of different bond issues and pick the right ones that go up, because you want your line looking like this. And, it's kind of going like this the whole time, but it's trending up. And that's why when you buy a bond fund and mutual fund family, it's a performance. Well, the problem with bond funds, and in a big managed pool, you can absorb that because you've laddered it and you've projected it. But in bond funds in the short term, I'm going to take our Keynesian short term versus our Adam Smith long term. What happens is when a bond fund, which is marked to market, net asset value is the face value of those, the market value of the bonds, which is determined by the market. And when you get a big surge quickly in interest rates, it automatically collapses the value. And these bond funds have been really, really slammed, not only by the Federal Reserve tweaking, which is sort of predictable. And that's why you always hear, as these open market committee meetings are scheduled and they're coming up, people start talking about that weeks ahead of time. Ooh, the Fed's going to meet in 3 weeks or a month, and they're will they raise? Will they cut? Because it's important. And then the market is instant. The market is a really instant clearing. And with digital technology, it really is. I mean, there's no way that you're going to, beat the market or time the market. The market acts real quick. So if you're a bond manager and you're sitting on that's what you do, a bond fund, the idea was you sold the public, you're going to buy bonds and you're going to make the ladder go like this. Well, when you get a surge in interest rates, it knocks that apart. And a lot of these bond funds are really struggling right now. So if you are an investor and you bought a unit in a bond fund, the bond fund, in theory, according to the numbers, could be down 46% or 53% or some number. And you put 100,000 into a bond fund and you may only have like 60,000 left or 600,000 left or whatever. So the point is, this is a really turbulent time for investors. And of course, if you're big institutional money and you've got all these professional people, you plan for this stuff. I mean, this is, the what if scenarios. But when you're investing your money as an average American consumer, and you put it into a mutual fund, or it's in your 401k, or it's in your IRA or whatever, you're really at the mercy of the people managing the market. And the sad thing about any market is, statistically, in the Adam Smith long run, there's going to be as many winners as losers, because the market will find an equilibrium. And of course, there's as many winners as losers. So therefore, if you're in the fund that is a winner, you're probably happy. If you're in the fund that's a loser, you're very unhappy, because those are most likely, earned dollars coming out of your paycheck that were segregated or allocated with the expectation that they would grow into the future, and you'll have more money in the future. So when you get these inflections in interest rates, and you look and you say, boy, my bond funds are really down dramatically, that creates a lot of stress in consumers. And of course, what happens is, economists refer to this as the wealth effect. When you're numbers are up and your assets are doing well and your income is up, you have a perception, the wealth effect says that you have a perception that times are good and you spend more money and you'll take more risk. But when times are bad, the wealth effect suggests that you will tighten down and you'll try to recover from the loss. And of course, that puts continuing pressure on Americans consumers. And I don't like to label humans as consumers, but that's common jargon in the financial press, that the purpose of people is to consume, I guess. Well, when your 401k is down dramatically, maybe you're not going to take that vacation. Not that it matters, in real time, because the retirement money is supposed to be for down the road when you retire. But it still has that depressing effect on you psychologically, where you just start to cut back. And that adds, of course, to the student loan problem, the high interest rates, the high consumer debt interest rates, and all of that compounds itself to create a downward slump in the economy. So I thought it was a very interesting story. When you start to see how these interest rates are high, what it does to the existing portfolio of bonds. And I also noticed that the 10-year treasuries, the new ones, are issuing at 4.9%, almost 5%. Well, 2 years ago, they were at, you know, like 2.5%. So that's a 100% increase in interest. And basically, mathematically, it should chop the value of that bond in half. And ultimately, we're seeing that pressure at the wrong time, I think, in this economic cycle. Then we start thinking about this the situation again in the Middle East. I know we're it's all over the news, and it will be. And I think this is not over, and it's not going to be pleasant to watch. But when things like this happen, these triggering events can have long-term ramifications on a global level. I noticed one story today that there's a pipeline, a gas pipeline, that runs from Finland to Estonia across the Baltic Sea. And there are allegations that it was sabotaged by somebody. And it brings you back to that the pipeline situation, the Nord Stream pipeline, which is the Russian pipeline to Germany, and of course Finland to Estonia, and then that's north, and of course that networks through. What's effectively happening is that we're entering the winter season. As anybody in the northern hemisphere knows, that, you know, we're in mid-October and the nights are getting colder, and that's when people turn on the heaters and try to keep themselves warm. And as the supply of natural gas that comes into mainland Central Europe is affected by the Ukrainian situation with the Russians, there's all sorts of strategic advantage to continue to constrict the natural gas into Europe when the seasons are getting cold, when we enter into the winter season. And of course, when you look at the Ukrainian situation and the effect it's had on energy costs in Germany, it's been rather dramatic, and this isn't going to help, because this is yet another pathway for gas to flow. And the question is, you know, who's doing this to the pipes? And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories about who actually blew it up. But at the end of the day, you're starting to see this constriction in natural gas flowing into Germany, which is primarily Central Europe, you know. And what it tells us from the American side of the pond is that we look to liquefied natural gas as a supply line and an alternative. And of course, that will put upward pressure on liquid natural gas, which is a process of pulling gas out of the Gulf of Mexico and cooling it into a transportable liquid, and then you got to have this refrigerator ship, and these are cooled temperatures that, you know, chug along all the way over to ports in Europe, and they connect it up and, you know, expand the gas. And effectively, you can move gas without a pipeline by shrinking it or cooling it. And that's what liquefied natural gas is all about. But what that does is it takes American gas capacity, it's not transportation capacity, this is volume. I should use the word volume. American natural gas volume. And it ships it off to Europe because the prices are higher. I mean, and Germans are freezing, they're going to pay a lot of money for gas. Well, that also costs America, because when you think about how we're structured, the Gulf of Mexico is nice and warm, and places like up here in Wisconsin, it's very cold, and we have, you know, natural gas that flows up from the Gulf through the Chicago hub into Wisconsin, and then, of course, our gas also comes down from Canada. But what happens is, as there's less supply and a constant demand, the price goes up for the lower amount of quantity, and everybody's gas bills are going to go up. That's basically the story. So these global events have an impact on us here in the U.S. And when you see that pipeline story, first thing that crossed my mind is, you know, we've had that Nord Stream pipe that's been down since, what, 2022, I think, you know, since, 2022. Well, now we're entering into the winter of 23-24. And this is going to have an impact on the American consumer, who's already struggling from, the student loans kicking in and higher interest rates, higher food prices, higher gasoline prices. Although yesterday I was talking about, West Texas Intermediate crude prices collapsing. It was $14. It was $97, collapsed $14, which is sort of an aberration. And gasoline prices over the weekend, at least in our parts of town here, were, you know, in the 329 range, which was a real relief when you go to fill up your car. But, you know, when you've got this turmoil in the Middle East, those of us old enough, and I mentioned this yesterday, remember with sufficient clarity that the price of gasoline went up very fast and very high. I remember back when I first, you know, achieved that glorious token of youth, youthful transition to young adulthood is your driver's license. And I remember having my driver's license and paying $25.9 for a gallon of gas. And the very next year, the Arab oil embargo hit and it went to 50 cents. It was a doubler, and then it ended up being close to a dollar. Well, let me tell you, that put a little crimp in this teenager's, you know, mad money budget. And it was a real eye opener, because immediately we went from big, beautiful, long, heavy American cars to very small cars. And of course, that opened the door for the flood of Japanese imports that have now become such a staple in America and car market. I mean, so many Americans really appreciate the quality and the pricing of Japanese-made cars. I mean, they're superb. And then now you see Korean cars coming in, and won't be long before we'll see Chinese cars coming in. But the point is, it opened that market and it changed the American economy rather dramatically, because the big three Detroit automakers, Chrysler, Ford, and GM, and then to some extent American Motors over here on this side of the lake, really dominated the American market. But that oil embargo, these big companies just couldn't react fast enough. And the Japanese, being a small island with a small place and small cars, they were just very well suited to coming in, and they grabbed market share. And even the Germans with the Volkswagen Beetle, we all remember that. It was the whole idea was it's a higher mileage car, and people, the market is the marketplace. And people said, yeah, I want 23 miles to the gallon instead of 8 miles to the gallon, because gasoline prices were going up and up and up. Well, we don't know how this situation in Israel is going to bounce, but I did see news stories that Saudi Arabia is backing away from negotiating treaties with Israel. And of course, they're one of the world's greatest producers of oil. And the Gulf states will you know, basically stick together. And of course, Iran is a major global producer of oil, as is in Iraq. And, you know, this is not going to end well. So if we do see another, you know, I guess we used to say the Arab oil embargo, but I would say it might be just an oil embargo by, you know, interests, people, you know, this permanent interest in the oil space, Americans could actually see a rather brutal shock that gasoline prices could. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but this can fit the model. If this thing goes the wrong way, I mean, you could be looking at $5 or $6 a gallon gas, because it depends what happens. And of course, if it doesn't go the way the oil producers want it to go, Russia's not coming to our rescue, because we're on the other side of the Ukrainian situation. And so, you know, Russia's a major producer, and the Middle East is a major producer, and the United States is a major producer. So 2/3 of our supply is in unfriendly hands. And that becomes a real problem for the American consumer, because American foreign policy has been nothing but bizarre in the last couple of years. And we really don't have the leverage necessary at this point to be energy independent. And if we are, it's going to be at a much higher price, which means price goes up, demand will obviously go down. A lot of people will be walking, because you just can't afford to be putting $8 gas into your car. So we're going to be watching this very carefully. And of course, you know, we don't watch the brutality of war through the lens of economics. It's a terrible war, is a terrible thing, but wars have consequences. And one of the consequences is Americans are going to end up being involved in this global turmoil. And we can't just assume that our government can spend $33 trillion and hand out money for everything under the sun. We're in the worst financial shape that we've been since World War II, when you look at the numbers. And this is no time to start thinking about a general mobilization. We're entering dangerous territory. And I think those in Washington really need to start thinking about how do we make America a wealthy country rather than absolutely strung out on debt with consumers that are completely tapped out. And I think that's the big policy question that we'll be talking about this week, because it's a question. These are questions that need to be answered by our political leadership, and they better start answering fast because we're running out of time. Anyway, I'm running out of time. Thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate your viewership, and thank you so much for supporting WVW-TV. Have a great afternoon. Bye.